First today, when it comes to American politics, there are closers and fixers and Sherpas and whales. Didn't know that? Neither did I, and I've been covering this stuff for a long time. In the halls of our nation's capital, it's possible to bork a nominee and slow walk a piece of legislation. Well, sooner or later, if you have even a passing interest in politics, there's a good chance you'll hear one of these expressions and wonder where you can go to learn what it all means. Well, one answer is with us here this morning. Chuck McCutcheon and David Mark are here. They are the authors of Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes, Decoding the Jargon, Slang, and Bluster of American Political Speech. And they're here to decode Washington speak for us, and in some cases, statehouse speak. Chuck McCutcheon is co-author of The Bible of American Politics. That's National Journal's Almanac of American Politics. He joins us this morning from Washington. Chuck, nice to have you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
David Mark is also with us. He's editor-in-chief of Politics and author of Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning, and he joins us from the Bay Area of California. David, good morning to you, too.
Good morning. Happy to be with you.
Well, I just love some of these terms. Chuck, what's a bedwetter in American politics? Because I wouldn't want to be one, although I got to tell you, I've known a few.
A bedwetter is a worrywart. politics is an exercise in, appearing as confident as you can. And, when people express doubts, the people that are trying to maintain confidence, this was a popular expression that David Plouffe used during Obama's presidential campaigns, is often described as a worrywart. But Republicans use it as well. They also consider people who kind of stray and start to express doubts bedwetters as well.
And David, who's a body man?
Body man, if you watch presidential politics, you look at television coverage of, say, President Obama or Mitt Romney in the last campaign, you usually see a youngish guy, usually a young man behind one of the not a Secret Service agent who's looking over their shoulder. They usually have a backpack or something of that nature. It's somebody who is meant to support the candidate with everyday needs. That might mean keeping their favorite food handy. In the case of Mitt Romney, it was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Or some candidates like to have hand cleanser after shaking all those hands. Not an unreasonable position request. So it's somebody there to take care of every woman need. And they are required to be with the candidate all day and all night. They really become like family members.
So, David, how did you know that Mitt Romney likes peanut butter and jelly sandwiches? Where did that come from?
That came from a New York Times story, I believe, in the spring of that campaign year, who captured some of it. And you get all these little quirks for the various candidates. For President Obama, he always wanted to have his BlackBerry handy. That was back in 2008 when that was the hot technology. That was Reggie Love, his body man. And this goes back years to President Bill Clinton, who ran through a series of these. And he was, early in his presidency, he was known for his kind of forceful temper. And then he would calm down and become buddies again with the body men.
And Chuck McCutcheon, a Sherpa is who exactly? What's a Sherpa?
Oh, well, this is somebody who's usually brought in to help somebody from a presidential administration win confirmation from the Senate. And they're usually most prominent during Supreme Court nominees. Former Indiana Senator Dan Coats was used.
That's right.
To help get Harriet Myers through the confirmation process. I think even Missouri's own John Danforth was a Sherpa for Clarence Thomas.
Clarence Thomas, you bet.
Way back when, yeah. But they also can be lower-level figures that do kind of the unglamorous but the important behind-the-scenes work in other contexts. There's a woman at the Treasury Department who has often described as a Sherpa for the International Economic Summit meetings that the presidents get involved in with other heads of state, things like that.
Well, I want to ask you guys a few questions about how you pulled all this together here. What's a whale in American politics speak?
That is one of the funnest definitions that we had to come up with. It's something that it's kind of like a roller coaster at casinos. These are the biggest campaign donors that candidates are trying to go after. In the most recent presidential election, Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas billionaire, was a huge contributor to Mitt Romney and Republican causes generally, and particularly in this post-Citizens United era after the Supreme Court ruling allowing more outside money. Both parties have their whales, so to speak, that they go after, whether it's somebody like Sheldon Adelson or George Soros on the left, who, of course, funded Democratic campaigns about a decade ago.
You know, Chuck, where do these words come from? Who comes up with these terms like whale and bedwetter? Who's out there inventing all this stuff? Maybe it's you two guys, so you could do a book.
No, I wish that were so. It'd make it so much easier. We found that they came from a variety of different sources. The most popular expression in our book, the one that's most often cited, is my good friend, which is what people often call each other on the House or Senate floors when they can barely stand each other. And that's descended from, you know, the British Parliament, where they refer to each other as the right honorable gentleman. Emanate from the legal world, you know, which is not surprising given the number of lawyers that, are prevalent in politics. We've had a number of terms come over from the spy world, walkback, which is in our title being one of them, and blowback, another term which was popularized in the intelligence community. And I think that, we've seen recently that there have been recent events that have coined words. For example, with Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader's primary defeat, the term cantered has now come to symbolize a wholly unexpected and unanticipated political loss.
Which is sort of similar to getting borked, as in Robert Bork, the one-time Supreme Court nominee back in the 1980s. What was that all about?
Yeah, that's when it was really almost unprecedented to challenge judicial nominees of the other side, and it really means, at least according to critics, to make unfair accusations. Defenders of Bork at the time, Ronald Reagan's Supreme Court nominee, didn't like how some of his legal precedents and opinions were being interpreted. There were various pieces of information about his personal life, even his video rentals, which now sounds arcane, but back in the day, that was high technology, and that it's basically short for going after somebody else's opponent just for partisan purposes, not because they're unqualified, just because you don't want them in power.
We're talking this morning about Washington speak and even State House speak with Chuck McCutcheon and David Mark. They're the authors of a new book, Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes. You know, I can just imagine you two guys sitting around having a beer after work one day and maybe saying to each other, we've got to do a book on bedwetters and whales. Am I right about that, Chuck?
Yeah, I've wanted to write a book like this for a while. It started when I started covering politics, and I started hearing the word disingenuous a lot. And it dawned on me that it's really the polite way to call someone a liar.
Liar, you bet.
And not just a liar, but someone who's really deluded and clueless. And I just kind of started mentally collecting these kinds of code words. And then Dave and I started talking about a book, and we said, well, why not do something like this?
You know, why is politics, David, so full of these little insider words that tend to confuse lay people out there? I mean, why politics? Why so much code here?
That was actually one of the compelling reasons that led me also to want to write the book, adding on to what Chuck said, in that a lot of these people in high office, in Congress, even in the state legislature, at a lot of different levels, actually were very successful in their previous lives. Many of them were, say, trial lawyers, where they had to had clients that they had to defend, or doctors, performed surgery, or some of them were military leaders or business executives. And in those roles, they presumably had to exercise independent thinking and critical judgment on their own. And it just struck me, covering Congress, that once they got into office, they would just start repeating the same tropes over and over again, and how almost disappointing it was. And I think part of it is fear of getting caught by the media if they say one thing out of line. Some of this they are actually told by image and message consultants when they run for office, no matter what you've done in your previous life. just keep saying the same things over and over again. And I think they just feel that the path of least resistance to get reelected.
You know, was it difficult, Chuck, to compile enough words here to actually come up with a book, or were you overflowing with possibilities?
Well, we tried to set some limits on what we did. We didn't want to do any kind of words that have kind of entered common parlance, you know, like wonk, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really – we tried not to do issue-specific words that you hear a lot, like amnesty, for example.
Oh.
We really wanted to look at words that were used in a variety of different contexts. And so – and we also wanted to avoid you know, a lot of the parliamentary jargon, you know, like cloture. In fact, we quote Claire McCaskill in the book as complaining about the phrase, can we get cloture? Can we get cloture? Cloture, of course, refers to the 60-vote hurdle.
Yes.
That virtually any piece of legislation has to deal with in the Senate now. And McCaskill told us, you know, to most people in America, it sounds like an improper sexual act. So it's just one of these things that you know, is gets thrown around a lot and used when, you know, there are probably other more relevant terms.
She might have preferred that people just say, do we have 60 votes for this or not?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, let me get our listeners involved here. If you have a question about a favorite or maybe a not-so-favorite Washington expression or political expression that you've always wondered about, this is a great time to call 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888 as we try to decode Washington and all these words that get tossed around the Beltway and what they really mean. Our guests again are Chuck McCutcheon and David Mark, author of Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes. Did some of your friends, David, end up offering you ideas, and parents and brothers and sisters just, hey, I heard this word, go after that one?
We did. We canvassed our fellow political journalists, people who work in and around politics. We also, fortunately, were able to interview several former members of Congress and also Michael Steele, the former Republican National Committee chairman, a state senator I know in North Dakota, and several other people who are active in or have been directly involved in electoral politics. And that actually brought out some of our favorite terms. Martin Frost, he's a former Democratic congressman from Texas. He was in Democratic leadership in several roles, told us about the phrase minimum high regard, as in I hold my opponent's ideas in minimum high regard. It's sort of a cousin of my good friend.
Yes.
A very thinly veiled backhanded slap at somebody is saying, yeah, I can't stand what you're doing, or you yourself.
Yeah, the first time I heard that, I did a double take. I was like, he said what? You know, really? Yeah, I get that one. Chuck, what's your favorite personal slice of jargon from this book?
Oh, boy, there's so many. I thought the one that was most instructive for me, and I think Dave would agree, is the phrase, we need to have a conversation about, because we realize that President Obama in particular says this a lot, and he does it as a way, whenever there's a controversy that's rising that he really doesn't want to have to deal with. I mean, he said it a lot on racial topics. He said it after the Edward Snowden revelations on the National Security Agency spying. He said it after Colorado and Washington State voted to legalize marijuana. It's kind of become his code word for, you know, everybody just, you know, stop speculating and just pay attention to my view of things.
Mm-hmm. David, do you have one that you would point to?
One that was new to me coming into the book, which I've really come to appreciate, is Overton Window, which sounds like a phrase out of a Star Trek episode, but it's really meant to define the quote-unquote acceptable range of political beliefs. It's named after the head of a conservative think tank in Michigan, and on the left, this might be, say, a single-payer healthcare system, or on the right, eliminating the national income tax, replacing it with a sales tax or something of that measure, something that you kind of get on the fringes of both parties, but the mainstream politicians don't really want to go that far. Even what became Obamacare never really contemplated a single-payer healthcare plan, and outside of the margins on the Republicans, you don't get people pushing too much to end the national income tax.
Yeah, yeah. You know, some of these expressions just make me smile, and I've heard them a million times. How about this one? What's a wingnut, Chuck?
Well, I mean, these are, you know, people who are at the sort of the extreme fringes of either party. You know, they often can be used to describe Democrats. I mean, Dennis Kucinich, the former Ohio congressman and presidential candidate, was derided by Republicans as a wingnut. But it's or it's become more commonly used to describe, you know, Republicans who are far out on the extreme right. And they're often wingnuts can often be another phrase we use in the book, which is a bomb thrower.
I was going there next.
Somebody,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Who basically just kind of indiscriminately, you know, puts out inflammatory statements. But a bomb thrower, we take pains to note, is different than an attack dog, who often does it in an official capacity, you know, for a presidential campaign or something.
And David, there's also something else that's very synonymous here: wacko bird.
Right. This is a relatively recent invention. This came from Senator John McCain criticizing members of his own party's Republican colleagues, who he thinks are insufficiently aggressive on foreign policy. They did not necessarily want to bomb Syria or have send military advisors to have military action in Ukraine or something of that nature. So more basically isolationist types, and not just Ron Paul folks, but he aimed it specifically at Ted Cruz, the outspoken Republican senator who he said was not being sufficiently loyal to Republican ideal. So it's interesting that that's an intra-party one that has caught on. And of course, because John McCain said it, it really became a big deal very quickly.
And if Ted Cruz wants to call into our show and sort of rebut the wacko bird label, we'll give him every opportunity at 816-235-2888. Then there's some other expressions I just absolutely love. There's this phrase, reasonable Republican. That sounds like a compliment, but Chuck, is it?
Well, again, this is something that Democrats use. Mm-hmm. It's their version of what a Republican should be. And Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid pulls this one out all the time, as in saying, if we only had some reasonable Republicans, you know, who would work with us and take our side, that sort of thing.
You know, I'm wondering if there are any words or phrases that have withstood the test of time and are still around from maybe even the founding days of our republic.
Boy, I think there's variations of them. You know, one that got applied really to one of the founding documents in the Revolutionary era was common sense, the pain track, which of course it's evolved into something else now. Politicians use that as a way of describing their own proposals, like, oh, common sense tax reform, or for the Democrats, common sense gun control. It's a way of taking a position that's actually quite controversial and making it sound like, oh, how could anybody be opposed to this? So I think a lot of these terms have kind of just evolved over time. Sometimes they've been through three or four incarnations to what we know of them today.
And just to be clear here, these are not obscure expressions that you would go to Washington and not hear. If you spent a couple of days on the Hill, you would hear a whole mess of these, if I understand things right, Chuck.
Oh, absolutely. And as we tried to make clear, it's not just Washington. It's like everything else. It's just more magnified here. You know, I've heard these in state houses and city councils and other things like that. I think it's sort of the language of politics in general.
You guys point out in the introduction to this book that people have been complaining about, you know, I guess the murkiness of politics for a long time. In fact, George Orwell once weighed in once upon a time about all this. What did he say about it all, David?
He was kind of going back to what we know of it today, that politicians use this to deceive. In his view, this was politics in the English language. He inveighed against euphemisms and question beggings and sheer cloudy vagueness. And he basically said politicians, British, American, whatever they might be, are out to try and fool you, and you have to be on your toes to guard against that.
D.C. also has its workhorses and its show horses, David. What are we talking about there?
Yeah, this comes specifically from a list in Washingtonian Magazine, which is, as the name suggests, chronicles what goes on in the Beltway area, both socially, political, et cetera. And it's actually been around before then, but they've kind of taken it to new heights. And it really gets to the two types of lawmakers, those who are real serious legislators who sit through the committee hearings, read through the legislation, offer amendments in a careful, thoughtful way, and really don't always go for the limelight. And then you have those who are just the show horses, which is sort of related to bomb throwers and even attack dogs in some ways, those who just love to preen for the television cameras but actually don't get much legislation passed. And they've always been around, but I think in this Internet, Twitter era, they get so much more attention than they otherwise would have.
You know, and again, some of these, the phrase, as you know, which means what? Exactly the opposite of what the speaker intends when he uses those words. What does as you know mean?
Oh, well, I mean, it's in politics that often means as you should know. You know, it's a subtle way of either reminding people of something you've accomplished or pointing out something that someone, in fact, does not know. And you know, and conferring the status of truth on what may just be only a matter of opinion.
And a common sense proposal is one that nobody could possibly disagree with in under any circumstance, right?
Right. Of course, it's usually anything but that. And this is one that Democrats have actually had a lot of trouble with in recent years, where they when they fought for gun control proposals after, to get serious for a moment, after all the mass shootings in Aurora, Colorado, Newtown, we could go down the line of these tragedies, and Democrats usually pull it out and say, we just need common sense control, which is different from what they used to say about banning handguns, et cetera. But so far, that hasn't really gotten them very far. In fact, you had a series of state legislators in Colorado who were recalled after pushing, quote-unquote, common sense gun control. So it's one that politicians actually have to be careful of using and going too far with.
And the other one that, again, is just the opposite. I'm sorry if I offended anybody. Not really.
Right. Well, anytime you've got if in an apology, it's safe to say that the person isn't particularly sorry.
Oh, I just love those. Why have you guys? I wanted to ask you both, just for the few minutes we have left here, about some questions about the current political landscape. And one thing that's going on is this, it seems to me anyways, this boomlet of interest suddenly in Mitt Romney again, the 2012 Republican presidential nominee who likes, is it peanut butter and jelly sandwiches? And he keeps saying no, no, no to the idea of running again. But yet, does no in this case really mean no, David?
With him, with somebody like Mitt Romney, you never know. I've got my own intuition about this, is that in the end, he's not going to do it. I think his most teasing comment was, circumstances can change. And Mitt Romney, brilliant businessman, good family guy, lots of virtues, but he's not a natural politician. And even saying that was not the most coy, deft way he could have gotten across those circumstances. He might have been better to have surrogates do it, to wait a little bit longer.
Yeah.
I can't imagine him coming out and being successful at this again. He gave it his best shot. My own sense is that whoever Republican nominee is going to have a tough challenge just with the Electoral College map. And I just can't imagine Republicans handing it to him in this day and age. We're not in the Adlai Stevenson era where you get another shot at it.
You know, Chuck, what is it about our country that, you know, someone who is holding out and saying no, we just rejected him for president for the second time. Now he's saying he doesn't want to run again, and that seems to stir up this fervor in the country, at least among some Republicans, who now suddenly think he's the guy to get. And why does that happen? We just said, again, we've rejected him twice, and now we want him. At least some people do.
Well, I think it's because even though he lost, you know, he still was able to command, what was it, something like 48% of the vote. And there's probably thinking among certain elements of the Republican establishment that, you know, given Obama's current unpopularity and if he ran a better campaign, he could add at least just 3 more percentage points to that. But, you know, he had the name recognition, the infrastructure. You know, I think it's just the realization that, you know, everything's in place, and that, you know, it's like anything else. You know, it's something that you is a known quantity as opposed to something that you're taking more of a gamble on.
We have a couple of listener emails here. Chuck has written in to ask us this. Could you guys discuss the term vetted? Where did this term come from in political use? It seems this term is used more and more these days. Where did it come from?
It's a term, it means to look back, to investigate somebody's background, to really do a detailed background check and try and find out if there are any skeletons in their closet. It's not clear exactly where the one comes from. It's been around for a good chunk of time, but it's really used by both members of both parties.
Hmm. And Michael notes this, before George W. Bush, the term resolve was just a carpet cleaner. That's what he says. Does that sound about right?
Right. And in that case, I think that's kind of a post 9/11 term where George W. Bush's defender said, at least, you might agree with him, you might disagree with him, but at least he has resolve. At least you know where he stands. And I think that worked in the 2004 campaign just about 10 years ago. By 2006 in the midterm elections, people said, yeah, you can be consistent, but you can still be wrong when it comes to Iraq and other such issues. So it's funny how these terms sometimes are positive, then they can get turned on their head in not too long a period of time.
You know, going back to the 2016 presidential picture, what happened to Jeb Bush as a potential front-running Republican candidate for president? I mean, you just don't hear anything about him anymore. Is he just lying low, David, or how do you size him up right now?
A couple factors. One is the Bush name, and his mother, the former First Lady Barbara Bush, has said it. There just may be too many. Three, just maybe too many, even though Hillary Clinton, the wife of a former president, is the front runner for her own party's nomination. My own sense of it, though, just having watched him and covered Jeb Bush over the years, I just don't think he has the proverbial fire in the belly, to use another cliche, in that he really is loving partisan politics, where you have to get out there and bash the opponent and live and breathe it 24 hours a day. I think he likes being a policy wonk and dealing with ideas, which he knows from his family's lifetime in politics is awfully different from winning elections.
And Chuck, is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, is he back in the picture for Republicans even after that you know, notorious Bridgegate controversy earlier this year?
I think he's going to be an interesting person to watch. The Bridgegate thing has receded to some extent, although there are still investigations going on. But you're starting to see a lot more attention being paid to you know, whether he really lived up to some of his campaign promises and the state's economy and things like that. And I know that in the New Jersey media, you know, it's been written and commentators have said that these issues could be just as big, if not bigger, than the whole bridge scandal.
And finally, David, Hillary Clinton, just to get a Democrat in here, she keeps saying, wait, wait, wait. Is there any question that she's running for the White House in 2016, or is there still at least a smidgen of doubt out there?
I think there is a bit of doubt in that there are questions sort of at the margins brought up about her health or various personal issues between her and Bill Clinton, but that's just kind of chatter on the sidelines. There's every reason to believe that she will run again. But I would just add, she may have something similar to what Mitt Romney would face in that she's had high approval ratings as Secretary of State. But once she jumps into the fray, all the old stories about Whitewater and, of course, Benghazi, that's more recent, this and that will come up. And the image gets tarnished real quickly, which is the biggest reason why I think Mitt Romney, staring back to that for a moment, would not run.
Well, Chuck McCutcheon and David Mark are the co-authors of a book, Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes. Very fun read. And Chuck, again, is co-author of the Bible of American Politics, the National Journal's Almanac of American Politics that I have thumbed through and tear up every couple years when that thing comes out. David Mark is the author of Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. Sure enjoyed having you guys. Thanks so much for taking some time.
Oh, thank you.
All right, guys. All the best.